One, here it comes.
Congratulations.
Hey there, and welcome back to Marvel by the Month, a weekly podcast about the monthly publishing history of Marvel Comics. My name is Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
And this week we are going to be talking about comics that were cover dated May 1963. So we're going to run through the list here. We've got Amazing Spider-Man number 2, Fantastic Four number 14, Journey into Mystery number 92, Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos number 1. That's a new entry. Mm-hmm. Strange Tales number 108, Tales of Suspense number 41, and Tales to Astonish number 43. It's a pretty stacked deck.
Yeah. Seven issues to get through.
Seven issues. We're going to go through these. We're going to prioritize the ones where we feel like we've got a lot to talk about because there's a lot of stuff that happens, or they just wind up being a lot more interesting, honestly. And then there's, you know, a few stories where we will check that box and move on. But before we get into any of that, let's talk a little bit about what was going on in the world when these comics were on the newsstands. This would have been March 1963.
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff going on this month, as opposed to last month. It was a little dry. On the 5th of March, we have in Camden, Tennessee, country music superstar Patsy Cline, whose real name, Virginia Patterson Hensley, was killed in a plane crash along with fellow performers Hawkshaw Hackens, Cowboy Copas, and Klein's manager and pilot, Randy Hughes, after returning from a benefit performance in Kansas City, Kansas, for country radio disc jockey Cactus Jack Call.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this before, but as I'm putting together the show notes for what happened during the months that we talk about, there are so many plane crashes. It's ridiculous. I honestly can't believe anyone actually got into airplanes in the 60s, because it's like literally 5, 6, 7 a month.
Yeah, we lost a lot of people to plane crashes.
And speaking of airplanes, the first confirmed penetration of United States airspace by Soviet military aircraft took place on the 15th of March. A Soviet reconnaissance plane flew over Nelson Island, and another made a pass over Nunavak Island. Both of those are in Alaska. So, Cold War is still heating up, and the Russians and United States are just playing a crazy game of chicken with each other that no one was quite sure where it was going to wind up.
And no one wanted to know.
Nope.
Then on the 16th, the British scientific journal Nature published an article by Martin Schmidt entitled 3C273.
Oh, it's my favorite scientific paper.
A star-like object with large red shift, marking the first announcement of the discovery of a quasar, a quasi-stellar radio source.
Yeah, and because we have to tie everything back to a Marvel comic, in the 1980s, Quasar was a superhero.
Yeah. He had some cool bracelets, basically. We'll talk about it in a billion episodes from now.
On the 21st, Alcatraz Island was closed as a federal penitentiary because it cost twice as much to operate as other penitentiaries in the federal system. So they transferred the last 27 prisoners. Attorney General Robert Kennedy said, shut it down. And they did. And then also on the 21st, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, gave approval for the first vaccine against measles,
awesome.
Which is great and, you know, would be great for another 20 or 30 years until a bunch of wealthy ladies in Southern California decided that vaccines, that the cure is worse than the disease somehow. That's what a life of privilege and ignorance will get you.
Shucks. And oh, this is good. We mentioned a little bit about this last month in Marvel history.
Mm-hmm.
On the 22nd, the Beatles released their first album, Please Please Me, that they recorded so hastily and well. This record we will be talking about in future episodes, as well as it charted very quickly and stayed on the charts for 70 weeks. And it hit number one.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So it's called the British Invasion for a reason.
Yeah, seriously. I got one more airplane story. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
All right.
It sure it goes well.
All right. So this is just nuts. It's not particularly historically significant. It's just a crazy story. On the 29th of March, a bolt of lightning struck the nose of a TWA Boeing 707 after it took off from London on a flight to New York. It tore a 21-inch by 8-inch hole in the fuselage. The pilot jettisoned 10,000 gallons of fuel while circling for 35 minutes over England before he could finally land in London again with his 110 passengers. Among those 110 passengers were 22 Methodist ministers, MGM Films president Robert O'Brien, and Warren Beatty, the actor.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking the Methodists might not be in good with the big guy if they're going to get there. But they did land.
They did land safely.
This plane did not crash.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
And of course, again, because we have to tie everything back to a comic book, Warren Beatty was Dick Tracy in the not hugely successful Dick Tracy movie.
Yeah. Incredibly not successful for all of the promotion.
I went to a midnight showing of that movie with my buddy Mark Patterson, who was the owner of the comic book store in my hometown. we spent like the few hours before that cleaning up the store, the once a year, the annual like vacuuming and cleaning of the place. And then as a thank you, he took me to the midnight showing of Dick Tracy. So
I think I went, you know, during the first week, but I don't have that cred. And finally, on the 30th, the first direct dialed transatlantic telephone calls were made between the United Kingdom and the United States through switching stations at London and White Plains, New York.
Yeah, this is kind of incredible. So this is the first time that you could pick up a phone in the United States and just by dialing numbers, you could reach someone in England. That was not possible before the 30th of March, 1963. So when you see some of this futuristic technology in these stories, you know, when supervillains are watching on monitors or Reed Richards is wildly impressed by a portable TV receiver, like it helps to kind of put it in context where it, like, yeah, that actually was kind of magic.
Yep. It was complete magic at that point. Yeah.
So, I mean, at the time, all of those stories that we've talked about were written. You couldn't call England without getting an operator involved. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Well, that's what's going on in the real world. So let's go ahead and jump in and talk about what is going on in the Marvel world. So the first book we're going to talk about is the first issue of Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. The story is called Seven Against the Nazis. So, yes, it's set during World War II, although depressingly, it could also be set in modern times. War comics were a hugely, hugely popular genre in the 1950s and in the 60s as well, and even to some degree in the 1970s. Usually the titles would focus on U.S. military activity during various conflicts, usually World War II or the Korean War or leading into the Vietnam War. DC Comics had a bunch of war comics that they published, All-American Men of War, Our Army at War, Our Fighting Forces, Star-Spangled War Stories. Charlton Comics, a now defunct publisher, also published a bunch of titles. Quality Comics published G.I. Combat during the era. So there were a ton of these books out there. And, you know, the comics industry is notoriously imitative, and Marvel was no exception. Stan Lee, Jack Kirby decided they were going to whip up a war book, and so they came up with Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. Mm-hmm. So both Jack and Stan had military experience in World War II. Stan was he worked for the Signal Corps. He repaired telegraph poles and communications equipment. He later wound up working on training films and writing manuals and things.
Writing, which only makes the, you know, Captain America PSAs more hilarious now in our time.
Yeah. But Kirby was also, like, he was a legit war hero and saw, like, more actual action than Stan did. He was a scout, and he had a line about his service, where he basically said, if they want to kill you, they make you a scout. So, you know, he was always, the guy who had, no reinforcements backing him up, and he had to be, the first to sneak around enemy lines and figure out what was going on.
And he liberated a concentration camp.
He did. Yeah. He was one of the first soldiers on the scene. Wow. Yeah. And obviously that's a huge, heavy thing for anyone to experience, but also let's remember Kirby was Jewish. And so, that I think had to add, so much more to that experience, and just how overwhelming and helpless he must have felt.
And on the other hand, how much he wanted to fight Nazis.
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Like literally Kirby would fight Nazis anywhere, anytime, whether it was World War II or in the decades following. Mark Evanier, who was Kirby's assistant in the '70s, has later went on to become a comic writer and a cartoon writer in his own right. And published a great book about Kirby, called Kirby King of Comics. He tells a story where Jack took a call. A voice on the other end said, "There are three of us down here in the lobby. We want to see the guy who does this disgusting comic book and show him what real Nazis would do to his Captain America." To the horror of others in the office, Kirby rolled up his sleeves and headed downstairs. The callers, however, were gone by the time he arrived. So it's like, and you got to figure, Kirby's got to be what, like late 30s, early 40s, the youngest, at this point.
Just sitting at his desk drawing 4 million comics every day.
Yeah. And also not a big guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he's just tough as nails. It's amazing. Kirby and Lee whipped up Sergeant Fury. He's pretty clearly a knockoff of DC's Sergeant Rock, the tough as nails sergeant. He's got a squad of do or die soldiers who they see all of the danger and never get any of the glory. It's a real melting pot. It's a very American collection of fellows. So you have Nick Fury, the sergeant, the leader, 6'2" of steel muscled, iron nerved fighting man. Then you've got Robert Rebel Ralston, who's an ex-jockey from Kentucky. He's a little guy, but he's a lot tougher than his size makes him appear. Dum Dum Duggan is Nick Fury's corporal, his second in command. Just got a really fetching bowler hat, and with his
corporal mustache,
with a walrus mustache and his corporal stripes.
But he's a former one-time circus strongman.
Yes.
So he, a former circus strongman. So he, he comes by the big mustache, but he has to fit that stereotype.
Yeah, yeah. And it's professional pride.
Yeah.
Then there's a Junior Juniper, who he's a kid straight out of an Ivy League college. He's a cheerful, eager beaver. And he's always smiling, but also super deadly. So don't get any ideas, Nazis. And then, rounding out the company, you've got Gabriel Jones, who his character description is basically he blows a trumpet. He's a big jazz fan. He's also the first African-American character with a name in a Marvel comic. So, tiny little steps of progress. And then you got Izzy Cohen, who is pretty much the first, overtly Jewish character, in a Marvel comic. Years and years and years later, they'd retcon, Ben Grimm as Jewish, as a tribute to Kirby. And of course, Lee and Kirby themselves were Jewish, and they are technically Marvel Comics characters because they showed up in Fantastic Four. Cohen, his character description says he can repair anything except the sorrow in his soul when he remembers the fate of his relatives in Europe at the hands of the mad little man with the mustache. So that's about as direct as Marvel Comics will ever get to commenting on the atrocities of war. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely a core part of the character. And then you got Dino Manelli. Hey, he's walking here. It's
basically Dean Martin.
Yeah, it's exactly who it is.
He looks like Dean Martin.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah, and the story itself, it's pretty by the numbers. We're actually not going to go through it beat by beat. You know, basically, Nazis captured the leader of the French underground, who knows the time and date of the invasion of Normandy. So Fury and the commandos need to rescue the hostage before the Nazis can break him prevent D-Day. And of course they do. You know, there's a ton of last minute heroics. There's some near misses. All the commandos make it through and they complete the mission. So, you know, all these stories kind of follow a really similar format. You know, they're meant to make you feel good about America's patriotic superiority over incredibly clearly defined villains.
Right. And we even get to see, I mean, we get to see Hitler himself.
Oh, yes. Hitler makes a cameo. A villain.
Yep. Yeah. So they're, as Fury's obviously winning, like he's getting to this important person.
Yes.
Hitler's on the phone berating them that if they don't get the information out of the hostage, he will have his lieutenant shot. He will have everyone shot. Do you hear me? Answer me. No, don't dare speak while I'm talking. It's just like a nice, you know, little caricature of it. I mean, it really actually just looks like Hitler, like not a caricature.
No, he's a mad little man with a mustache. Yeah.
And there's a lot of loving attention paid to the weapons. The tanks, the very specifically, and there's even a wrap up splash page of describing the different basically revolvers or handheld pistols of each of the allies and Axis, describing their calibers. It's crazy. You know, it's definitely for anybody who's into that, which in that time was anybody. We're past World War II, but it's still
riding high.
Still glorified, and we're in the Cold War, so we're still, you know, there's a lot of flag waving, and just bizarre to see that splash page of describing great detail each of these weapons.
Do you remember in the 80s there was, I can't remember what it was called, but there was a Punisher spinoff series where all it was basically the Punisher talking about guns.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was just like gun porn. Like the whole thing was just gun porn. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird, but it still was a good story. Like I feel I expected it. Honestly, I did not, you know, I don't care for war stories that much. Although there's a few.
Sure.
But
Garth Ennis can tell a good war story.
Yeah. I'm willing to pay for that, but this was, much better than I thought it would be, especially as we get into some of these other issues. Even it still had a more cohesive, solid story, which was nice. You know, when you're talking about straightforward things and not trying to over explain some magnetic electric ray.
it's a solid debut. Fury obviously winds up becoming a pretty important character in the Marvel Universe. We'll talk about all that in a little bit. I don't know that we're going to walk through every issue of Sergeant Fury every week on the podcast because, you know, again, they don't really fit into the superhero universe. It's just sort of it's a long game because obviously Fury winds up running S.H.I.E.L.D. At some point and then winds up becoming much more part of the universe. But, you know, this is still basically a 20 years earlier prequel to the Marvel Universe. So. You know, if there's something that comes up that we think is going to be relevant to what we're going to be talking about going forward, we'll definitely be sure to mention that. But otherwise, it just might be, you know, Fury and the Commandos slap some Nazis around this month. and that's that.
Yep. Well, let's get into the Fantastic Four.
Oh, yes, please.
Issue number 14, The Merciless Puppet Master, which is weird. That's the name of the story, but on the cover, we get a nice view of Namor's butt.
Yeah, front and center.
Yeah, we're looking through he's ready to grapple. We're looking through his legs and seeing the guise of the Fantastic Four coming, and we see Sue all tied up. So,
a little something for everyone.
Yeah, just weird. So, what happens in this issue? Turns out the Puppet Master didn't die from his tumble out of the window at the end of his debut. He makes a puppet of Submariner and uses it to control Namor and get him to lure Sue Storm out of the Baxter building and capture her. And that's fairly convoluted, but it works out.
yeah, he's got a hypnotic fish.
Yeah.
That hovers behind. So Namor is hypnotized, and hypnotized Namor gets his friend, who is a floating
hypnofish. Yeah.
It literally is a hypnofish. I just made that up, but then I looked to see what it was called, and it's called a hypnofish. Sue meets him on the docks, and the hypnofish hypnotizes her and then like forms a giant bubble around her and takes her down to Namor's undersea lair.
So naturally, the FF pursue Namor and Sue to the Submariner's lair, and they free Sue. Then the Puppet Master orders Namor to kill the Fantastic Four, which he struggles against because of his feelings for Sue. So again, we still see this recurring theme with him where he really digs her and he does not want to make her mad by, you know, killing her brother and, you know, boyfriend.
Yeah. And we should also mention that up until this point, he's been really just fighting to defeat the Fantastic Four. So he got a he has like all these weird undersea creatures. He's got something called a flame eater, which looks like a like kind of a staff with two giant puffballs on the end of it that sucks up Johnny Storm's flame. He throws a super sharp piece of coral at Ben to distract him. And then throws a deep sea fungus on him that grows all over him and traps him in this giant snowball looking thing. So he's pulling out all the weird undersea monarch stops.
Right. But without taking on the power of some weird sea creature that we saw that in Strange Tales last time, he's actually not. He's using other items, so right. He's using other sea creatures to help.
Yeah,
him.
The idea of Namor being able to duplicate sea creature powers that's gone by this point.
So, and it's notable that Puppet Master wants Namor to kill the Fantastic Four. He's not trying to capture them or prove himself better. He's like, he's all the way to crazy villain time.
Yep.
So Namor's been resisting. A giant octopus that Namor was using to guard Sue breaks out of Namor's lair and attacks the Puppet Master's sub. Breaks out as it sort of happens because Ben is wrestling with it. So it gets free.
Yep.
Puppet Master can't carve an octopus puppet fast enough and he's pulled down into the depths.
This is one of my favorite parts of the whole story. He's just like, he's frantically, he's got his little pocket knife.
he's whittling this.
Yeah, but he also had to put his radiation suit on, you know, because it's radioactive clay, remember?
Yep.
So he's like whittling and he's like, oh no. And yeah, just gets sucked down to the depths, and that's it for the Puppet Master. Probably never see him again.
Nope, that's it. Yep. So with the Puppet Master gone, Namor regains his mind and has no memory of the battle. He orders them to leave, which they do. The end.
Yep. That's pretty much it. But Namor actually has a parting shot for Reed before the Fantastic Four leaves. He says, now return to the surface. You have no further business here. Take the girl, Reed Richards. Take her and hold her if you can. But heed my words. Never shall she forget Prince Namor. Just, yeah.
Almost, I don't think it's on this album, the Please Please Me album of the Beatles, but You're Gonna Lose That Girl is coming up in a future album.
Awesome. Fun Fantastic Four story. I think this is the third time we've seen Namor in the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and then we saw him in Strange Tales too. So yeah. He's around. He's a staple now.
Oh yeah, totally.
All right.
Okay. Well, I'm super excited to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 2 because the Ditko and Lee's Spider-Man is probably my favorite comics of all time. It's right up there with the Lee and Kirby Fantastic Four. So this is the second issue of Spidey's ongoing series. And like the first one, it's a two-parter. So there's two, I think, 12-page stories. The first one is Duel to the Death with the Vulture. and the second is The Uncanny Threat of the Terrible Tinkerer. So, taking them in order, the Vulture. He's on a crime spree. If you don't know what the Vulture looks like, he's an old man in a green body stocking who has green arm wings, and he flies through the air. He looks very vulture-y.
Yeah. Not exactly tough, but grumpy.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, looks like he could probably peck your eyes out with his nose.
Mm-hmm.
So he's on a crime spree. J. Jonah Jameson, publisher of the Daily Bugle, and also, was it Now Magazine?
Now Magazine,
Now
yeah.
Magazine is the, it's basically like a Time or a Life magazine. He wants pictures of the Vulture. So this gives Peter Parker the idea for the first time to take pictures as Spider-Man to make money for him and Aunt May. Because remember, by Jameson launching his crusade against Spider-Man, Spider-Man can't make any money as an entertainer anymore. And Peter and May are really struggling because with Uncle Ben's death, they're really in rough shape. So Peter decides, hey, I could become a photographer. I could take photos in my Spider-Man gear. I can get places no one else can. I can, you know, make money and support my aunt.
And May even pulls out Uncle Ben's old miniature camera,
yeah,
to give him. So it's got this callback already to, you know, something really meaningful to this death that happened in the original issue.
Yeah, yeah. It feels
or Amazing Fantasy, that is.
Yeah, yeah, it feels very almost, you know, Uncle Ben is guiding him from beyond the grave. Spidey hits the city with the camera. He uses his spider sense to find the Vulture. He gets a few pictures of the Vulture, but as he's messing around with the camera, the Vulture sneaks up behind him and drops Spider-Man into a water tower. Spidey normally could just use his web shooters and get out through the top of it, but he's out of web fluid, so he has to do a super powerful leap out through the top of it, by the time he gets out, Vulture's long gone. So Spidey heads home to upgrade his equipment, more web shooter cartridges.
Yeah, and luckily the camera did not go into the water with him, so
right.
He still got the camera,
yep,
with the film.
He tinkers around and builds a little device that he thinks will stop the Vulture, just by judging from some of the stuff that he saw Vulture doing when they fought. So the next day, the Vulture has announced his intention to steal a shipment of diamonds from the Park Avenue Jewelry Exchange. The cops are out in force. There's plenty of bystanders and spectators. They're all looking up in the sky for the Vulture. So he surprises them by coming up through a manhole, stealing the diamonds, and then escaping through the sewers. Spider-Man is in hot pursuit. He follows the Vulture. He winds up using the gadget that he built to disrupt the magnetic field that powered the Vulture's wings.
Yeah, there's a lot of notes about how quiet the Vulture is. So he's, you know, he's like an electric car. He's just swooping in and no one can hear him. They can't figure it out. So apparently genius Peter Parker did and made a device to stop him.
Yeah, because don't forget, Spider-Man's other superpower is that he's a crazy smart science kid.
Yeah. I think that's his main power.
I think it is, yeah. Too. Yeah. With the wings disabled, the cops easily capture the Vulture. J. Jonah Jameson pays Peter handsomely for the photos, which would be the last time that happens.
Yeah.
Peter and May are finally in good financial shape again. Is this a happy ending?
It's a happy ending in the middle of the comic book, but
right.
Yes, it is. He, in fact, Peter's like, hey, Aunt May, I'm going to pay the rent for a year and you can get something nice, some appliances you've drooled over. So he's like, he made enough money off of those pictures to pay a year of rent. So there,
yeah.
He's out of that hole. Just
no,
like that.
No wonder Jameson just lowballs him for the rest of his life.
Right, because he apparently paid a lot.
Okay, well, let's move on to the second story, The Uncanny Threat of the Terrible Tinkerer. So Peter's working as a research assistant to a Professor Cobwell, who asks him to pick up an antique radio that he was having repaired at a place called the Tinkerer Repair Shop. So Peter goes, he meets the Tinkerer, who is a creepy old dude. What is up with creepy old dudes in this story?
I don't know. Yeah, it's like youth against grumpy old guys.
I guess so, yeah. Surprise, surprise, this guy immediately sets off Peter's spidey sense. And there's a reason for that, because there are aliens working in the basement of the shop to repair radios and insert surveillance devices in them. Peter doesn't know this until he gets back to Cobwell's laboratory and his spidey sense is still tingling. So he investigates the radio that he got back from the Tinkerer. He finds the surveillance device and he decides he's going to head back to the Tinkerer shop as Spider-Man to figure out what the heck's going on here.
Yeah. When he's looking in there, of course, because his power is science, he can tell that there's a lot of things that should not be inside of the radio when he opens the back of it. So immediately he's like, this is totally nuts. I'm going back to the shop.
Oh, yeah. I have the feeling that like 7-year-old Peter Parker just dismantled half a dozen radios at Ben and May's place before they finally just, you know, put them up on a higher shelf. Spidey goes back to the Tinkerer's shop. The aliens wind up overpowering him and they capture him. But he frees himself with some fancy web shooting. During the ensuing fight, the alien's lair bursts into flame. As the place is starting to go up in flames, Spidey tries and fails to catch the Tinkerer, and then he has to escape before the place burns down. But during the attempt, he pulled off a rubber mask from the Tinkerer's face. So who was he really?
I am very curious about that.
All right, well, I'll give the spoiler alert for episode like 620 of this podcast.
I like our estimates of our future episodes.
So we finally figure out, we get the answer to what was going on there in 1981 in a issue of Spectacular Spider-Man number 51. Here's the deal. The aliens, and I'm going to put air quotes around that, they're actually criminals in disguise. The entire thing was just a charade that they were putting up to throw off anyone who might discover the operation. So they were fake aliens. Interestingly, in that same issue of Spectacular Spidey, which is retconning all of this, it also reveals that one of those crooks was Quentin Beck, who would better be known as Mysterio, who we will meet in just like a dozen episodes.
Yeah.
So that's what it was. There were no actual aliens involved, according to current Marvel history. They were just alien lookalikes.
Which is saying something, because they did, you know, streak away in a spaceship at one point.
Yeah. There's a lot of flying things in the Marvel Universe that could be spaceships.
It's probably just a stolen Fantastic car.
Yeah, relax, kid. Go back to sleep.
Okay, I won't think too hard.
All right. That's
action-packed.
Just a ton of stuff happens. That's a really dense two stories. That feels like two full issues of a comic book in one. So if we're... you know, figuring out which one is the best bang for your buck. I think Amazing Spidey, like get so much story out of that. Yeah.
And you get two villains that, you know, that are pretty big in the universe.
Absolutely.
Well, lesser so, over in Journey into Mystery, number 92, it's the day Loki stole Thor's magic hammer.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of Asgard. You know how we are about Asgard around here.
Yeah.
Loki's back. He's bound to the tree in Asgard with chains made of Uru metal, the same metal that Mjolnir is made out of. Lame Dr. Blake is forced to save the life of a gangster again, who was shot in a robbery.
This has happened a few times now, right?
Yeah. But Thor captures the crooks. So
also, this part of the story has nothing to do with anything else that happens in the story. And this is only a 12 or 13 page story.
Yeah.
So they just burn two and a half pages on this retelling of a story that they already told.
Yeah. I feel like it's just another it's another reason to have an awkward time when lame Dr. Blake says, look the other way, and taps his cane. And then they're like, how is Thor right where lame Dr. Blake was just standing? And yeah. he says, he hid, and whatever. it's just ridiculous every time. So I think he says he's hiding for fear there may be some wild shooting is what he says.
Yeah.
When they say, where did Dr. Blake go? Thor, you know, captures the crooks. Then Thor helps out a film crew by doing all of their special effects for them. And it's like a Viking pick. So yeah. they're like, the Vikings ask for the God of Thunder to come help them and fight a serpent. And he just does it. So that would be an awesome movie, much better than some of the, you know, attempts later. Yes. But yeah. not, you know, in recent memory, they're doing pretty good.
Yeah. This isn't the, like the Thor appearance in the Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk oh. TV show. I just remember Stan Lee hyping that up in Stan's soapbox for like 6 months before that came out. And then I watched it, like, and I was still a kid, you know, I did not have super discerning tastes.
Right.
And even still, like, I looked at that, it's like, what a piece of crap. Like, God,
I mean,
it,
I was
Stan.
Totally
you
taking
it.
Again. Yeah. I was taken in by the Hulk in that show.
Yeah.
I,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I did see Lou Ferrigno in the makeup at Universal Studios as a kid.
That's wild.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Nice.
So Thor helps out that film crew. Cool. On Asgard, Loki uses his sorcery to cause Thor's Uru hammer to be attracted to Loki's Uru chains and shatter them, also immobilizing the hammer. So Thor doesn't have a hammer, but he says, Dad. And calls out to Odin and Odin helps him get to Asgard. He grabs
Odin, like 200 foot tall Odin appears in the sky and literally picks Thor up in his hand
like a little action figure
and takes him to Asgard.
And good news, Thor doesn't change back to lame Dr. Blake after 60 seconds when he's in Asgard. So we find that out, and we all want Asgard to happen more often.
I was going to say, that is not that we need another argument to have more Asgard in Thor comics, but that is the best argument for it.
So Loki keeps sending monsters against Thor, but Thor keeps crafting substitute hammers out of anything around him, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's like he's being attacked by monster trees, so he chops down a tree and makes a giant wooden hammer and like smashes it up.
It's cool.
Yeah.
And he like carves one out of stone with his finger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ultimate tough guy move.
Then he finally gets his actual hammer back, and Odin, Heimdall, and Fricka vow to find a better way to imprison Loki. Good luck.
Yeah. 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 I'm sure you'll get it this time.
And that's the last we ever hear of Loki.
Yeah. Is this the third or fourth time Loki's shown up, and they've still not managed to figure out how to lock that
down?
No,
which is, it's pretty in keeping with actual Norse mythology.
Yeah,
like they're always trying to imprison him, and he's always finding some way. I think in one story, and I'm sure it'll be covered at some point, he has to get someone to cry for him in Norse mythology.
Yep.
And he finds a way to do that. And it's really nefarious and mischievous because it's Loki.
Yep.
So
that's the way he works.
So that is Journey into Mystery. At least it is a Loki, issue.
Yeah. It takes place almost exclusively in Asgard. And we see Fricka, or I think more commonly known Frigga, Odin's wife, the mother of the gods. So, bit by bit, we're getting more and more Asgardians in and fleshing that out. So that's cool. Running a little long on time. So what do you say we just knock these last three out pretty
Let's
quickly? Okay.
You want Tales of Suspense?
Yeah, I'll do Tales of Suspense. I'll talk a little Iron Man here. Exciting news. The title of this story is called The Stronghold of Doctor Strange. Less exciting news, it's not that Doctor Strange. This guy's a villain who is hit by lightning, which, quote, increased the electrical energy of his mind.
He doesn't even live on Bleecker Street. He's just some guy.
He's just some guy. So this Doctor Strange is in jail, but he builds a device to remotely hypnotize Iron Man and order him to break him out of jail. During the escape, where Iron Man is flying him across the countryside, not that Doctor Strange reveals that he wants to take over the world in order to make it up to his daughter, who he neglected for years in order to devote himself to what he calls a fantastic life of crime, which is like, I like that he has some regrets, but not a lot of regrets.
Right. And to solve his, you know, focus on crime, his obsessive focus on crime, he just gets more crime.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, I crimed my way into this. I'm going to crime my way out. So anyway, Dr. Strange holes up in his lair. He holds the world hostage with 200 megaton bombs. That's each bomb is 200 megatons. He doesn't have 200 bombs, mm-hmm. but he's got enough, he says, to destroy the world many times over. But Iron Man, now that he's free of Dr. Strange's influence, he tunnels his way into Strange's stronghold, gets into a scrap with him. Not that Dr. Strange gets the upper hand. But Strange's daughter intervenes and saves Iron Man from her father by tossing him some flashlight batteries to help him recharge his armor. That's enough to get not that Dr. Strange to flee and promise his revenge. He never returns. we never see this guy again.
That is a promise broken.
Yep. So, which is also funny because like during the story, he has this reputation as being, like, everyone in the world knows who this guy is, and he's such a diabolical bit. He's never see him again. Yep. Oh, wait.
Okay. You want to talk about never see him again? Well, kind of maybe see him again, but let's talk about Strange Tales number 108.
No better you than me.
The Painter of a Thousand Perils. So imagine Paste Pot Pete with a fedora and a dumber power.
Yep.
So where to even start? The painter is a guy named Wilhelm van Vile.
So that's a pretty cool name.
Yeah.
Van Vile.
Sounds like he could be in Misfits, maybe.
Yes.
Who has magic paints that bring to life whatever he paints. Okay.
And it's kind of inconsistent, right? So it's like sometimes he paints a scene on a canvas and that scene actually happens in the real world. And sometimes like he paints a thing on the wall and the thing comes to life.
Yeah.
Right. So there's not really any hard or fast rules for this.
It's magic.
It's sure magic. Just forget about it, kid.
So he broke out of prison and discovered a cavern. He was digging under the prison, discovered a cavern with the magic alien paints in it.
Yeah, I mean you're skipping through a lot of stuff, but honestly it comes down to being literally that bizarre. There's no point in going into more detail on that.
Yeah, I just said magic alien paints. So yeah. What we have, possibly technology, aliens.
Yep.
We have magic.
Yep.
So he has these paints.
Whatever. And it's a cavern under his jail cell.
Yeah. Yeah. So he just he didn't have to dig super far.
No.
Lucky the aliens had put their paints there some time ago. The painter then commits a bold jewel robbery in the middle of the day and is ready for the torch to show up. The torch defeats him with an absolutely insane twist of logic.
Yeah.
This one is bizarre. Just to try to explain it.
Yeah, give it a
tiny
shot.
Bit.
Yeah.
Johnny figures out that the paint is somehow magic and makes things come to life. So at some point, he paints a dupe of himself.
Yes.
Which is later captured by dupes of the Fantastic Four that were painted.
Yes.
And as all that happens, right when Wilhelm van Vile thinks he's won, Johnny, the real Johnny, shows up and burns all the paints and the canvas, which he could have burned when he found them at any point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So also not cool. And there you go. Strange Tales, I guess.
Yeah. This
wasn't a Lieber story.
Yeah, that's true.
R. Burns.
Yeah, who's a guy named Robert Bernstein. He wrote I think a very few EC comics back in the day. After the Comics Code had crushed the original EC comics and they were still limping along for another few months. I think he wrote a story or two there. He wrote a lot of Superman stories, which you can actually kind of tell from reading this, because this absolutely reads like a 1950s or 60s Superman story with like these insane leaps of logic. And I don't know, something about it, like when you read those old Superman stories, it's kind of charming because everything is just so absolutely insane. And, you know, there's an element of fantasticalness to it that works really well with that character in that universe. But, you know, in the Marvel universe, where we're trying to have more grounded stories.
And stories that take place in the world, in New York City.
Exactly. Yeah. Doesn't really work so well.
Speaking of that, you want to tell us about Tales to Astonish number 43?
Yeah, I guess I drew the Ant-Man straw this week. okay, well, here's how it goes. I'm going to do this in 50 words or less.
Tweet this one.
Okay. The Astonishing Ant-Man versus the Mad Master of Time. So it features this old dude named the Time Master. He is actually named Elias Weems. He was fired from his job as an inventor because he's too old. And his place of employment is totally fine with just saying, nope, you're over 65. Get the F out.
Yeah. Like, ageist galore. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to believe that was probably illegal, but maybe not in the 60s. I don't know. My wife is an HR professional. I should ask her. Weems creates a device to get his revenge. This device can age and de-age people. He's going to teach the world a lesson by aging everyone and making them feel old and useless too. Ant-Man stops him. Weems accidentally catches his grandson in it and ages him, and he's like, oh no, what have I done? And then he reverses it and he vows to be an upstanding citizen from now on, and he gets his old job back because he invented this amazing device.
Do you think maybe he could have de-aged himself a little bit? Like, maybe just used it right out of the gate to just be a little younger and be like, hey,
yeah,
give me a job. I'm a new scientist, whatever.
please, Elias Weems was my grandfather. You can call me. I don't know.
Draculia.
Yeah. But he, Time Master never shows up again. Ant-Man doesn't do anything different, just the same old catapulting into a pile of ants that he always does.
I do think the one notable thing, at one point in the story, Henry Pym becomes normal sized to get somewhere faster.
I noticed that. I forgot to mention
somebody
that.
Must have written enough letters of the things we've been talking about where they're like, why does he just ride an ant? How long does that take?
Yeah.
You know,
So
he makes himself a normal traveling size.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. Great job. It only took that long to think of it. Okay.
Okay, cool. So let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, let's talk about, let's recap a little bit and talk about what mattered about this month going forward. So let's do a quick little recap here. We're going to talk about what actually mattered about this month, what's going to wind up coming back and influencing Marvel Comics stories going forward. So I think one of the big ones is the debut of Nick Fury, the future agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the future director of S.H.I.E.L.D., Dum Dum Duggan, his second in command, also winds up being a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. We already mentioned, you know, Gabriel Jones is the first named African-American character in a Marvel comic. And Izzy Cohen was the first obviously Jewish character in a Marvel comic. So a little bit of ethnic diversity, which is really nice to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's slow coming. And it's still going to be a while before, you know, you get anything even remotely resembling, you know, adequate representation. But baby steps.
Yep.
Fury's here. Duggan's here. Two major characters in the Marvel Universe going forward.
Yeah. And then over in Spider-Man, we get, as I said earlier, we get the Vulture, who is a major villain. We get Peter Parker, photographer.
Yes. Yep.
How he makes his money and gets into a great explanation for why and how he gets into a lot of trouble.
Yes.
In the future and in this issue. Then the Tinkerer debuts as well. So the Tinkerer, oddly, you would think by reading this issue would never recur again,
right.
but he does. He does quite a bit, and he does a lot for other supervillains in the future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Tinkerer winds up being the plot device he's the answer to the question, where do all these supervillains keep getting their stuff from? They get it from the Tinkerer. That's fine.
Yeah,
and you know. Night Nurse fixes everyone up, and the Tinkerer makes all their gear. Yeah. Like, that's it.
And you read Tony or Hank Pym.
Yes.
Sometimes McCoy.
Yep.
Are the ones who help you get anything else fixed in on the hero side.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I feel like there's got to be like some kind of tech tree or like one of those like infographics where you have like, you know, here are the centers of technology, you know, and gear in the Marvel universe. And, right. You know, like, you know, this is all Stark stuff and this is all Reed Richards stuff. And this is all Tinkerer provided, you know.
And then you get down to Peter Parker or Amadeus Cho later, yeah, you know, those kinds of things.
Yep. Yeah. So a ton of stuff in Spider-Man, which again, super dense comic and so much stuff that winds up influencing the character going forward. Mm-hmm. Even in Journey into Mystery, in the Thor issue, there were a couple things that were relevant going forward. And I already mentioned Fricka appears for the first time. And, you know, she is, I think, in mythology more commonly known as Frigga, although Fricka is also like a spelling and a pronunciation of her name. My guess is that the comics code had something to do with why they didn't call her Frigga.
That's freaking dumb.
I know, right? yeah. So she's Fricka for now. I know she winds up being Frigga.
Yeah.
Later on. So, but yeah, slowly but surely, Asgard's being fleshed out. The North mythology is creeping in. Lame Dr. Blake is being pushed to the margins. So, you know, it's another good foot forward.
Yeah. A limp forward. And we have the first appearance of a few guys who never show up again.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Get the name Doctor Strange, the not really Doctor Strange,
mm-hmm.
the Time Master, and the Painter.
Yeah.
Who does, weirdly, is the one out of those three who does appear a handful of times.
Yeah, I think Spider-Man runs into him really briefly again. But yeah,
like he dredged up some more alien paint under the prison. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like it's such a weird character to kind of go all in on, like, you know, or to go in on at all.
Right. To have exist ever again.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, what does he bring to the table that like the Puppet Master doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway,
I do like both of them. We have hypnotism all over constantly. Oh, yeah. Everyone's getting mind controlled.
Yes.
So that's still going on. We have these characters that have some weird magic or radioactive or magnetic power that is like doing something in the arts. That's what I love, the rapid whittling of the Puppet Master is still my favorite thing. It tickles me. And then the painter, you know, the other part of the magic of the paints is he can paint very quickly.
Oh, that's right. He can speed paint.
So I don't know if this is somehow like Stan making fun of Kirby or what's going on there. Yeah. They are art powers.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Well, I was going to say it's kind of a weird flex to like make all of the artists in your books the villains of the pieces. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Maybe Stan was always a little resentful that he couldn't draw as well as his bullpen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Who knows?
Possibly. Well, that's it. That's the seven comics.
Yeah. We got through that pretty well. I think all that remains now is just to talk about, let's single out a panel that we liked and we think kind of represents the month. The one I'm going to choose is from Spider-Man. And it's the very first panel from the very first page from the Vulture story. If I just think about this panel, I can see this panel. I have read this story so many times. The Vulture hovering high above the streets of New York City. You can see the rooftops. Spider-Man is gripping the Vulture's left ankle with his right hand, and he's got his right fist cocked back and ready to take a poke at him. But it's just this really graceful, almost like a yin yang symbol, you know, this crazy ballet in the sky.
Yeah. It's iconic.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And I feel like I've seen this tributed several times.
Much like the Mole Man's monster coming out of the street for Fantastic Four.
Absolutely.
One. This is something that's been maybe not as often, but you still see it, tributes done to it.
Yeah.
Every you know, 5 years or so.
Yep. And it's like, and Ditko's line work is just, it's so delicate and so detailed.
Yeah. And this is Ditko inking his own pencils. So yes. It's got extra Ditko.
Yes.
And even that, like the shadow of one of the wings of the vulture, it's just all black, which is this other interestingly Ditko thing. It's like, if you think of Sin City or Frank Miller, like this huge, or even Mignola, like this chiaroscuro contrast, that he's starting to introduce that. And it's not something that Kirby does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. You're absolutely right. What do you got?
Which leads me to set myself up. I looking through everything, there were a lot of funny things, but
yes, there are a lot of funny things this month.
Yeah. My favorite two panels are really weird. They're not that dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's just this in the Tinkerer story in Amazing Spider-Man number 2, so page 19 or page 5 of the Tinkerer section, we have panel 4 and 5. It's Spider-Man has just dropped into the Tinkerer's lab because he's suspicious, and you see this panel of him in the dark with his spider sense going off. So it's just the colors black and red, with his eyes as white and the spider sense as white. And it's so Ditko. He's just, you know, you can guess the rest of the shape based on what's there. And then the next panel is him headed down some stairs, and he's blended into the darkness as well. The stairs are there and you see a light at the bottom, but it's such minimalist, but this has not been done. It's like not a thing Kirby does.
Yeah.
And I love this kind of work, and I always strove to emulate it. And that's part of my graphic style. Mm-hmm. I try to minimize the in-betweens to sort of get maximum contrast to show the highlight details and then everything else into black.
Yeah.
And I don't do it. I mean, I can't say I'm great at this. I just try to emulate it.
There's only one Steve Ditko. I feel like this is an element of Spider-Man that has sort of been lost in the illustration style. I feel like you don't get a lot of the, you know, like Spider-Man coming out of the darkness.
Venom.
You get Venom. Exactly. Like, I feel like Venom kind of got all of that. Mm-hmm. But like, as soon as Spidey took off the black costume, like, artists forgot that it's like there's still a ton of dark, shadowy bits of the character costume.
Yeah, I guess McFarlane probably did hit on some of that when he rebooted that. And I should point out, or should admit, that there were two things I habitually drew as a little kid.
Yeah.
Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
constantly drawing Spider-Man's costume and the webs on the costume.
Yep.
And Eddie from Iron Maiden.
Nice.
So those, I was obsessed with Spider-Man's costume. I got to meet, you know, some dude in a suit at the Portland Comic Con.
Yep.
Back when it was just boxes on tables.
Yep.
But somebody showed up in a Spider-Man suit that was weird. But I still was like, I've got to get somebody with a camera to take a picture of this.
Yep.
It was a Polaroid that's long lost its. I was obsessed with this costume. So the Ditko drawings in this issue are near and dear to me.
Oh yeah. Yep. It's great. I just know that a lot of my panels of the month going forward are going to come out of the Spider-Man issues that we read. I'm such a sucker for Steve Ditko. I think early Ditko and late period Kirby are my two favorite comics artists, period, of all time.
And I had an idea you were going to pick something from Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to pick something from Spider-Man, but what kept recurring to me was these two little panels.
Yeah.
And I had to mention them just so I could, you know, talk about how unique it is.
Oh, too. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, great. I think we did some good work here tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have brought you along in through this 1963. We're going to keep going.
Yeah. That year doesn't end super well for America. But we'll keep that spoiler for another day. Until then, if you want to get in touch with us, please hit us up. You can email us at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Visit us on the internet at marvelbythemonth.com. And we're on all of the social media, but we're especially fond of our Instagram account, which is @marvelbythemonth. It's growing nicely. We put stuff up there several times a week, and hope to see you on there.
Yeah, hilarious panels, and Brian usually has something very funny to say about them. It's great.
It's my true calling.
Yeah.
The way I've been pitching the podcast to people is like, you know, the podcast is pretty good. Like, we're finding our feet. We're a great Instagram follow. So it's like, just follow us on Instagram, and you know, the podcast is coming along. It'll be great. Mm-hmm. It's already great. I'm pretty happy with it. And we're really happy that you guys tune in every week. So please do that again next week. And we'll be talking about some more of this stuff. So until then, I'm going to remain Brian Stratton.
And I will continue to be Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.